Welcome to Talking New Energy, a podcast from Delta EE, the new energy experts. We'll be talking about how the energy transition is developing across Europe, with guests who are working at the leading edge of this transition. Hello, and welcome to this episode. Today, we'll be looking at distribution networks. In the last series, we've focused mainly on the retail environment, companies that have relationships with and provide services directly to customers. But today we're focusing on the less glamorous but equally critical role in the electricity sector of distribution. And we may even stray into other energy vectors as well. In the old energy world, distribution networks managed the downwards flow of electricity and gas from the transmission system down to customers. Load growth was quite easy to plan. It tended to correlate well with economic growth. And customers' load profiles, the way they were using electricity, gas, didn't really change that much from year to year. But as the transition from old to new energy gathers pace, the challenges facing distribution companies is changing. And indeed, the nature of their role is changing. These challenges and evolution of the role of distribution networks is what we're exploring today. And I'm delighted to welcome two guests to today's discussion. First, Pallas Agdeberg, Director of Strategy at Alliander. Hello, Pallas.
Hello.
Pallas, for our listeners that aren't familiar with Alliander, a network company based in the Netherlands, can you give us a few facts and figures about Alliander and how you'd sum up your role there?
Sure. Alliander is a grid operator in the Netherlands, which means for about 40% of the Netherlands, we have more than almost 6,000 employees, 1.9 billion euro turnover, mainly situated in the Netherlands, with a small part in Germany too, mainly because of our innovative activities that we want to share with other grid operators. So we exchange information, we co-invest also in Germany.
And the balance of electricity distribution against gas distribution and heat distribution, what does that look like?
Practically don't do heat distribution, so it's like 40% gas, 60% electricity.
Okay. And the focus of your role, Pallas, how would you sum that up?
Yeah, strategy and innovation. Corporate strategy means, well, how is this market changing and how do we need to participate on that? And innovation is, also organizing the processes that need to deliver the innovations or new businesses that we tend to create to meet new challenges.
So I guess you're looking forward a lot of the time, but balancing that with the reality and practicalities of today's business as well.
Yes, that's how I want to have it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. My second guest is Dave Openshaw. Hello, Dave.
Hello.
Dave, you're an associate here at Delta Energy and Environment and spent your career in the UK's electricity distribution industry. You didn't move from the distribution network to working with us at Delta that long ago. So can you give us a flavour of your most recent roles and what your focus was in the distribution industry?
Sure. Yes, John. Thank you. I'm now an independent consultant, having formed my own company, Millhouse Power Limited, in 2015. And I'm delighted to be an associate of Delta Energy Environment and have worked with them on several projects. But as John says, prior to that, I was with an electricity distribution company, UK Power Networks, which serves the east and southeast of England and the majority of London. And I held a number of senior management roles at UK Power Networks, including Head of Asset Management, Head of Engineering and Regulatory Strategy, and Head of Future Networks. The focus of this latter role was really to prepare UK Power Networks for the future, which is really what we're discussing today. And this involved a wide range of RD&D projects exploring new technologies and commercial models. In terms of what I'm doing nowadays, in addition to my day job as a consultant, I also serve on the Institute of Energy Technologies Energy Policy Panel, which gives ad hoc advice to government on energy-related matters and policy. And I'm also currently involved with the UK Energy Systems Catapult in supporting the UK Electric Vehicle Task Force, which is charged with understanding the challenges and opportunities surrounding mass uptake of electric vehicles and its impact on the electricity system.
So, Dave, retirement's still a bit of a way away for you then?
Yes, indeed, John. It was supposed to be a transition path to retirement, but it continues to occupy my brain and keeps me mentally active, which is not a bad thing.
Yeah. Dave, can I start by looking back a little bit to your time at UK Power Networks and maybe less the innovation future-looking role there, but the asset management or role, for example. How, if you're looking back 5-10 years ago, how would you sum up the core elements of UKPN's activity, the core elements of the business role, business model, and the core activities?
Yes, I mean, it is fundamentally an asset management function because that's what distribution companies traditionally do. Uh-huh. They manage physical assets. And it was really about ensuring UK Power Networks met its license obligation, first and foremost.
Yeah.
In particular, ensuring the development of an efficient, coordinated and economic distribution system. And that means ensuring the safety of employees and the general public, protecting the environment, maximising regulatory incentive performance. For example, things like quality of supply.
Yeah.
You know, interruptions and so on. But what it really meant is having a really good handle on asset condition and risk of failure. To use the technical term, failure mode effect and criticality analysis, and being able to predict load growth, as you said, John, and putting in place appropriate asset replacement, maintenance, network reinforcement plans. But even then, UK Power Networks was exploring active network management alternatives to conventional network reinforcement. So the transition was just about beginning around 5 years ago.
Okay, so very much having the right assets in place, those assets being cables, transformers, etc., and making sure those assets were working well, managing the health of them.
Absolutely. And not replacing them too early or too late was
just a bit, so exactly the right
just
time.
In time.
Yeah.
That's right.
Pallas, how, looking at Alliander today, how would you relate that role of sort of asset management that Dave described to, is that still the core, the essence of Alliander today, or how have things changed in the last 5 to 10 years?
Investing in the assets in the right time, not too early, not too late, is of course one of the most important parts. And if you what we've been doing in the last 10 years or so is implementing a lot of measuring tools to actually know what's happening in the networks in a much more deeper level than we haven't known before. Mm-hmm. In order to be able to have this much better planning of asset investments than we had it before, because what we saw already 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it started, that this energy transition means that we will get a lot of new need for new capacity. And the special thing about it is, well, you mentioned in your introduction that we've come from a world where it's very predictable in terms of a million customers, and they all have the same type of usage of the network. So it's pretty much predictable upon really the last 5 minutes in a year, we know exactly what's going to happen. And this is completely changing because of energy transition. This decentralization of technology means that, for instance, solar on the roof in a certain street means, a doubling or tripling the capacity on a certain moment of the year. But you need to know on what roofs solar comes. So same for electrical car charging in the streets, but maybe public charging, where the charging point will come, where the solar will come, where the heat pumps will come, makes a lot of difference. And now we're 5 years later, 10 years later, we're in the middle of it. And it was very difficult to understand exactly what kind of dynamics we needed to know. Well, the dynamics we know now is that the problems we are facing right now is a certain demand for capacity for data centers. Yep. And for solar fields. And these solar fields are more or less subsidy triggered. But in the fields, just way out of the built environment and the industrial areas, just fields where nobody ever comes. That's the best place to put a solar field from a financial perspective.
But not necessarily for the grid perspective.
No, not at all. Yeah. So it's very difficult to know which field will be picked out. Yeah. And you cannot prepare for that.
So Panos, how does that...
This is really...
You've got to react then. And I wanted to ask you next about time horizons, because on one hand, you're putting assets in the ground that will be have a lifetime of many tens of years. Yeah. So your time horizon then is looking quite far forward. But it sounds like you need to be very reactive, as in this example of a solar farm on a weak part of your network, you've got to cope with things very quickly. So how do you think about timeframes and time horizons?
Yeah, there's more than just, of course, for these data centers, mm-hmm. I think it's about time horizons, and they come up very fast with new demand. Mm. And not realizing that their demand is so huge. Data center is like a medium city, mm-hmm. a big data center. You cannot put the power capacity for a medium city in 2-3 years. Yep. You need 10 years. Yep. So it's impossible to do that. And so we need to learn from that in terms of spatial planning, that you need to point out where the data centers, for instance, will come. Where, for instance, for these solar fields, what kind of policies do you need from a governmental perspective to mm-hmm. put them on the roof? Or where do you want to have these solar fields and where not? It's a very new perspective on this capacity triggering. So it's about speed, but it's also about planning.
Dave, what's your view on time horizons, or what have you observed and experienced in the UK, and how reactive people have to be?
I can echo everything that has just been said, really. I mean, the UK Power Networks covers the very rural areas of Norfolk, Suffolk and so on, but at the same time, central London. And I can certainly empathise with the data centre issue. It is literally like a small town appearing on a footprint of what used to be just a sort of an ordinary commercial building. Yeah. And, you know, it could be 10, 12 megawatts of power that you're having to cope with. And it is important, therefore, that you don't react, or you have to react, but at the same time, you don't react on an ad hoc basis. It's all about, again, going back to the coordinated and economic efficient development of the network. So having forward visibility of where those demand centers are going to be and then designing the network accordingly. In advance is really important. And of course, in the central business district areas, they tend to be summer peaking loads anyway. And so adding data centers with their air cooling load onto it just exacerbates a potential problem. But it also provides an opportunity for demand side response, which certainly UK Power Networks was exploring seriously in order to deal with unplanned network outages. If you could turn the demand down for an hour or two, that could alleviate a potential problem. But going out into the rural areas, again, wind farms on and solar PV farms on very weak parts of the network were also a major challenge and very, very difficult to predict, because developers would put in speculative requests for quotations and only a handful of those would ever go ahead. So you're always trying to predict what was going to happen and what wasn't. And again, we've looked at commercial models for exploiting, you know, the fact that the load factors are generally low, and therefore with a little bit of curtailment risk, if the developers are prepared to accept that, it means they can secure faster, cheaper connections in exchange for that very small risk of curtailment, you know, if there's a network outage at the time when they're exporting at maximum potential. So these are really, you know, important areas to try and manage the connection queue for renewables.
So that, if we looked at Germany, for example, I think the whole German sector got caught out by the huge rate of growth of photovoltaics, and that created a lot of challenges for their distribution network. Data centers, very hard to predict. Rural solar farms and weak parts of the network, hard to predict. Looking forward, Alice, how predictable, how have network companies got much better at predicting the future and understanding the new loads, sources of generation, connection requirements for the grid? Or do you think it's inherently very, very difficult to get that right?
Yes, I think it's not a technical issue. Of course, you need to have the technological part right, and you need to know exactly what the different type of loads do on your network. And we have all kinds of simulation programs and real-time measurements. But it's not enough. It's enough for just the maintenance, but this type of new investment we were just discussing is quite a different thing. And also you need to look out just to put in cover in the ground, because it's not just the access to the energy system that you want to provide. You also want to have it an affordable network. So this is why I just made this difference between these data centers that will be there for tens of years, or at least these areas will be developed for those type of period. But these PV farms in remote areas, they can be gone in 5 to 10 years. So you have put in a network that will not be used anymore. So this is about new ways of collaborating with local governments, and it is about being more smart and having the technology right, but it's also about collaboration and policy.
How would you relate that to, say, electric vehicles? I think there's general consensus that transport will be electrified. Homeowners will, where they can, charge their vehicles at home. Everyone knows that's coming. No one's quite sure exactly how quickly, and that will roll out. Can you invest and prepare for that ahead of need, or do you try and have to invest as the need is developing? Because I guess what you don't want to do is be caught investing behind the need and seeing problems on the network as people charge their electric vehicles at home.
Yeah, well, but in a way, it's like there's public charging and charging at home. For the public charging, we actually are making this nationwide planning already, and that helps a lot. But for at home, well, there's a difference between the rural areas and the villages compared to the cities. Mm-hmm. In the dense cities, it's still about public charging, and so we can influence that quite a lot. But well, at home, yeah, it's about you cannot just start upgrading all these networks, these low voltage networks, just because you think there might be some extra cars. So, and at the other hand, there's these cars, and this is, for instance, why we did vehicle to grid type of innovations. These cars with these batteries can also be part of the solution. Instead of just charging, they can also be storage. And so the smart part about that is opening up for flexibility. It's not just the volumes that you pay for, it's a time of use that's becoming more and more important. So we need to change this energy market from just the volume based as it was with these standard low profiles to flexible return balanced markets.
So that would help you deal with the challenge and I guess minimize the investment needed in copper in the low voltage network. Dave, can I ask you about your view on investing ahead of need? So the regulator wants you to be prepared, but the regulator also doesn't want money to be spent way in advance of when it needs to be spent and that to flow through to customers' bills. How do you see that balance between preparing but not preparing too far in advance of the need?
Yeah, classic dilemma, that one, John. And I was interested to hear Palace's comments on national planning, because that's one of the key recommendations that's coming out of the Electric Vehicle Energy Task Force, because there's an awful lot of public charge points going in, but no real visibility of UK-wide coverage. And so you could envisage maybe, you know, the more coastal areas, rural areas, you know, being under-provided in terms of infrastructure, and maybe over-provision along the motorways and trunk roads. So we really do need a better handle on where those charge points are going to appear. In terms of the charging at home, that will impact the low voltage networks first and foremost. And the key there is for DNOs to try and understand where that charging at home is most likely to occur. And the obvious thing is, you know, if you've got homes with off-street parking, they're obviously the most susceptible to home charging.
Yeah.
And for that reason, a range of smart or active network management solutions have been prepared, including, you know, active voltage management, load shifting between networks, or indeed between phases of networks. What that does is to give you some optionality, you know, pending, there may come a day when you still do need to reinforce, but at least it gives you time to analyze what's happening and therefore hopefully put the investment in place in good time.
I'd like to talk a bit more about that now. We've talked about how you can try and plan for the future, have a joined up approach to the future, predict, for example, where challenges will come from electric vehicle charging by looking at homes with driveways. But you've both mentioned different tools and techniques or smart solutions for, like, for example, vehicle to grid or a wind farm, switching off when the network's really stressed for those few hours a year. That's a different type of activity from the one, Dave, you described at the beginning, which was, I'm being exaggerating a bit here, but different from the traditional asset management activity. So looking forward, what will the role of a DNO or DSO, a network company, be? If in the past it was very much building assets and maintaining the health of those assets, looking forward to 5 to 10 years, let's maybe start with you, given your role is looking forward. How would you describe the nature of a distribution business in 5 or 10 years?
If I describe the DSO role or DNO role as is used in the UK often, it's two elements. It's asset management and it's market facilitation. We do the grids, we don't sell energy, we don't do any energy service related activities. So we create the data and the options for access to that market. So this is the market facilitation. It's like switching and the clearing houses, etc. But if these services change, then you need to change your market facilitation too. And this dilemma we were just talking about, the change of the energy business from the volumes in terms of this is the volume, the kilowatt hours you buy in a year, to it's not just the kilowatt hours, it's also the moments that you use or produce that's relevant. It's a change of energy services, which means a change in market facilitation. So if this capacity issue, like for instance, switching off a solar field in terms of in moments where there's a capacity issue, you could also say there's a different way of looking at things, two different ways. One is the grid operator just switches off if he thinks it's necessary. And the other one is, well, we've sold capacity to our customers. And if there's a lack of enough capacity, so let's give our customers the option to exchange this capacity that I've been buying. So and by doing that, you create a flexibility market for time of use, not only in energy production, but also in capacity for the network. And this is a completely different way of looking at things.
It is different. And how that's new, how challenging is that for a company like Alliandi, do you think, to have that as part of their core activity? Because traditionally, there'd be more asset management, this market facilitation and that example you used is quite different. That's quite a shift, isn't it?
Well, it isn't. I think it's not that quite of a shift because it's like the cables are underground and people sometimes forget that there's a lot of investment to put these cables in there.
Yeah.
But these computers that do the data for the switching and the measurements, etc., they're also invisible, but it's there. And it's one of the largest computer capacity in the country. For the energy, I mean. So it has been there, but nobody knew. And if we just change it in a way that congestion markets, flexibility markets are opening up, well, it's a little bit new, but I think not for us, but for our environment.
Okay, so some of that core competence is already there within the company, and then you're just using that in a different way.
Yeah, but it's I do agree that it's difficult to have these type of new things implemented, but we're working on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dave, how do you see that shift, or do you see the same shift that Panos described, and how challenging is that for network companies?
Yeah, I see a broadly similar shift, John. I see it as a two-stage approach, and I think where the UK distribution companies are well on the road to the first stage, which is becoming active network managers. And I alluded to a few commercial and technological approaches to active network management. It does require more granular data, you know, looking at network loading, asset condition diagnostics, all those sorts of things. But I think the next stage to that, which is the one that's more challenging, but which is being explored now, is how you use flexibility, not only for local network congestion management, but also for the wider power system. And in UK particularly, or Great Britain in particular, we're seeing a very rapid displacement of synchronous generation from coal and gas-fired stations to wind, solar PV, and a little bit of nuclear as well, of course. But what that means is that you know, the overall stability of the system is becoming lower because of lower inertia on the system. So that requires additional services like frequency response, short-term operating reserve because of the relative uncertainty of prediction of output from renewables. And therefore, there's a huge market for flexibility, as Panos said, not just for network congestion management, but also for, you know, upstream network services and system services as well. And I think the key role for a DSO transitioning from a DNO going forward is to make sure that flexibility is accessed, you know, to maximize the revenue streams for the service provider, you know, by making sure you can use all of that flexibility for the wider power system as well as the local network. And that's very much at the heart of the ENA's Open Networks project, which is happening as we speak in the UK.
Yeah, when I look across Europe, I see a number of demonstrations, trials, experiments, early developments with local flexibility markets, how you can use flexibility in multiple ways for different parts of the value chain in a coordinated approach. So yeah, I can see very much this is going to be a big topic in the next years, and something that's new, relatively new, not just to DSOs, but to a lot of players in the value chain.
Yeah.
We're getting to the point now where we need to start wrapping up, and listeners to the podcast will know at this time we normally bring out the talking new energy crystal ball. So I'd like to ask you each two questions, which can summarize the discussion. First question, if we look at a distribution company a few years ago, and if we look forward to 2030, what's the biggest difference we'll see in a distribution company? And then secondly, what's the biggest challenge to make that change or to see that difference? Panos, would you like to go first for that?
Well, crystal balls, it's always difficult to predict, especially regarding the future.
Yep.
And at the same time, in terms of 2030 for a grid operator, are just like tomorrow, because we build things for 30 to 50 years. And so I really hope that we can can just elaborate on what's happening right now. And that means that the way I just described from this asset management and market facilitation, that it's getting more and more clear that the decentralization of technology that comes with this energy transition makes it possible to do as much and much more at a local level, at home or in neighborhood or in an industrial area, which means that this microgrid thinking will be coming up a lot and optimizing on a very local level, leaving the networks, the backbone, for the distribution grid, and more or less as a safety system. And I don't know whether it will be flipped to a safety system in 2030, but this is a path we can look at. And then these microgrids need to be managed too. So maybe we will have a combination on active system management, not just on our own networks, but on local networks that are in possession of others. And making sure that this will work through electricity, gas, all kind of new type of gas and heat.
And the biggest challenge, in a nutshell, to get there? If you had to isolate thing in a sentence?
The bigger challenge would then be to really look at it from this system perspective,
okay,
the system management perspective, and organizing millions of actors on that system.
Okay. Thanks, Phallus. So, Dave, biggest difference from now to 2030 and biggest challenge?
Well, again, I'd agree with pretty much everything Phallus says there. And I think the opportunity...
I was looking for a bit of disagreement and argument today, but each other.
We're just to build on that. I think the opportunity for DNOs as they transition to DSOs is to also look at the opportunities they might have for additional revenue streams, not least for consultancy services, because, microgrids, energy communities begin to develop, but they're not generally very well served in terms of technical expertise. Mm. They've got some very good business sense around their propositions, but they can certainly take a great deal of value from experienced network operators, I think, in terms of, how you manage that sort of microgrid, what the risks are, whether it's connected to the distribution system or not. I think there's a role for greater scope for private network asset management as well. But I think the biggest challenge is really one of a culture change, really, for DNOs to think of themselves not just as regulated companies with, more or less guaranteed low-risk revenue streams, but also looking at opportunities for using that core expertise, to find new business opportunities. And I'm sure the opportunities are there if they're prepared to invest in the capability to do that.
But I guess a lot of network companies have unregulated businesses today, but the core part of their activity is running as a regulated business. So that's, I can see the difference in mindset required. Time has got the better of us, so we'll wrap it up there. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I feel we've just scratched the surface in some ways, but there's lots more to talk about in future episodes. Dave, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, John.
Phallus, thank you to you as well.
I was happy to be part of it.
And of course, thank you to our listeners for downloading the episode, and we hope you enjoyed it and found it stimulating. This is the last episode of Series 2, so we'll be back in September with Series 3, and we hope you can join us then. Thank you very much, and goodbye.